I nod.
We will not leave today.
Our men are strong oarsmen, but even they cannot power a full day's journey. We need the wind to take us to Troy. It does not come, not that day, or that night, or the next day either. Agamemnon is forced to stand in the marketplace and announce further delay. As soon as the wind returns, we will leave, he promises us. But the wind does not return. We are hot all the time, and the air feels like the blasts off a fire, scorching our lungs. We had never noticed how scalding the sand could be, how scratchy our blankets. Tempers fray and fights break out. Achilles and I spend all our time in the sea, seeking the meager comfort it offers. The days pass, and our foreheads crease with worry. 2 weeks with no wind is unnatural, yet Agamemnon does nothing. At last Achilles says, I will speak to my mother. I sit in the tent, sweating and waiting while he summons her. When he returns, he says, It is the gods. But his mother will not, cannot, say who. We go to Agamemnon. The king's skin is red with heat rash, and he is angry all the time. At the wind, at his restless army, at anyone who will give him an excuse for it. Achilles says, You know my mother is a goddess. Agamemnon almost snarls his answer. Odysseus lays a restraining hand on his shoulder. She says the weather is not natural, that it is a message from the gods. Agamemnon is not pleased to hear it. He glowers and dismisses us. A month passes, a weary month of feverish sleep and sweltering days. Men's faces are heavy with anger, but there are no more fights. It is too hot. They lie in the dark and hate each other. Another month. We are all, I think, going to go mad, suffocated by the weight of the motionless air. How much longer can this go on? It is terrible. The glaring sky that pins down our host, the choking heat we suck in with every breath. Even Achilles and I, alone in our tent with 100 games we make for each other, feel winnowed and bare. When will it end? Finally, word comes. Agamemnon has spoken with the chief priest, Calchas. We know him. He is small, with a patchy brown beard. An ugly man, with a face sharp like a weasel, and a habit of running a flickering tongue over his lips before he speaks. But most ugly of all are his eyes. Blue, bright blue. When people see them, they flinch. Such things are freakish. He is lucky he was not killed at birth. Calchas believes it is the goddess Artemis we have offended, though he does not say why. He gives the usual prescription, an enormous sacrifice. Dutifully the cattle are gathered, and the honey wine mixed. At our next camp meeting, Agamemnon announces that he has invited his daughter to help preside over the rites. She is a priestess of Artemis, and the youngest woman ever to have been so anointed. Perhaps she can soothe the raging goddess. Then we hear more. This daughter is being brought from Mycenae, not just for the ceremony, but for marriage to one of the kings. Weddings are always propitious, pleasing to the gods. Perhaps this too will help. Agamemnon summons Achilles and me to his tent. His face looks rumpled and swollen, the skin of a man who has not been sleeping. His nose is still red with rash. Beside him sits Odysseus, cool as ever. Agamemnon clears his throat.
Prince Achilles, I have called you here with a proposition. Perhaps you have heard that.
He stops, clears his throat again.
I have a daughter, Iphigenia. I would wish her to be your wife.
We stare. Achilles' mouth opens, closes. Odysseus says, Agamemnon offers you a great honor, Prince of Thyre. Achilles stutters, a rare clumsiness.
Yes, and I thank him.
His eyes go to Odysseus, and I know that he is thinking, What of Deidamia? Achilles is already married, as Odysseus well knows. But the king of Ithaca nods, slight, so that Agamemnon will not see.
we are to pretend that the Princess of Skyros does not exist.
I am honored that you would think of me, Achilles says, hesitating still.
His eyes flicker to me in a question. Odysseus sees, as he sees everything.
Sadly, you will only have a night together before she must leave again. Though, of course, much may happen in a night.
He smiles. No one else does.
It will be good, I believe. A wedding.
Agamemnon's words come slowly.
Good for our families. Good for the men.
He does not meet our gaze. Achilles is watching for my answer. He will say no if I wish it. Jealousy pricks, but faintly. It will only be a night, I think. It will win him status and sway, and make peace with Agamemnon. It will mean nothing. I nod, slight, as Odysseus had. Achilles offers his hand.
I accept, Agamemnon. I will be proud to name you father-in-law.
Agamemnon takes the younger man's hand. I watch his eyes as he does. They are cold and almost sad. Later, I will remember this. He clears his throat a third time.
Iphigenia, he says, is a good girl. I am sure she is, Achilles says. I will be honored to have her as my wife.
Agamemnon nods, a dismissal, and we turn to go. Iphigenia, a tripping name. The sound of goat hooves on rock, quick, lively, lovely. A few days later, she arrived with a guard of stern Mycenaeans, older men, the ones not fit for war. As her chariot rattled over the stony road to our camp, soldiers came out to stare. It had been long now since many of them had seen a woman. They feasted on the curve of her neck, a flash of ankle, her hands prettily smoothing the skirt of her bridal gown. Her brown eyes were lit with excitement. She was coming to marry the best of the Greeks. The wedding would take place in our makeshift marketplace, the square wooden platform with a raised altar behind it. The chariot drew closer, past the thronging, gathered men. Agamemnon stood on the dais, flanked by Odysseus and Diomedes. Calchas too was near. Achilles waited, as grooms do, at the dais's side. Iphigenia stepped delicately out of her chariot and onto the raised wood floor. She was very young, not yet 14, caught between priestess poise and childlike eagerness. She threw her arms around her father's neck, laced her hands through his hair. She whispered something to him and laughed. I could not see his face, but his hands on her slender shoulders seemed to tighten. Odysseus and Diomedes moved forward, all smiles and bows, offering their greetings. Her responses were gracious, but impatient. Her eyes were already searching for the husband she had been promised. She found him easily, her gaze catching on his golden hair. She smiled at what she saw. At her look, Achilles stepped forward to meet her, standing now just at the platform's edge. He could have touched her then, and I saw him start to, reach towards her tapered fingers, fine as sea-smoothed shells. Then the girl stumbled. I remember Achilles frowning. I remember him shift to catch her. But she wasn't falling. She was being dragged backwards to the altar behind her. No one had seen Diomedes move, but his hand was on her now, huge against her slender collarbone, bearing her down to the stone surface. She was too shocked to struggle, to know even what was happening. Agamemnon yanked something from his belt. It flashed in the sun as he swung it. The knife's edge fell onto her throat, and blood spurted over the altar, spilled down her dress. She choked, tried to speak, could not. Her body thrashed and writhed, but the hands of the king pinned her down. At last, her struggles grew weaker, her kicking less. At last, she lay still. Blood slicked Agamemnon's hands. He spoke into the silence.
The goddess is appeased.
Who knows what might have happened then? The air was close with the iron salt smell of her death. human sacrifice was an abomination, driven from our lands long ago. And his own daughter. We were horrified and angry, and there was violence in us. Then, before we could move, something on our cheeks. We paused, unsure, and it came again. Soft and cool and smelling of the sea. A murmur went through the men. Wind. The wind has come. Jaws unclenched and muscles loosened. The goddess is appeased. Achilles seemed frozen, fixed to his spot beside the dais. I took his arm and pulled him through the crowd towards our tent. His eyes were wild, and his face was spattered with her blood. I wet a cloth and tried to clean it away, but he caught my hand. "I could have stopped them," he said. The skin of his face was very pale. His voice was hoarse. "I was close enough. I could have saved her." I shook my head. "You could not have known." He buried his face in his hands and did not speak. I held him and whispered all the bits of broken comfort I could find. After he had washed his stained hands and changed his bloodied clothes, Agamemnon called us all back to the marketplace. Artemis, he said, had been displeased with the bloodshed this huge army intended. She demanded payment for it. In advance. In kind. Cows were not enough. A virgin priestess was required. Human blood for human blood. The leader's eldest daughter would be best. Iphigenia had known, he said, had agreed to do it. Most men had not been close enough to see the startled panic in her eyes. Gratefully, they believed their general's lie. They burned her that night on cypress wood, the tree of our darkest gods. Agamemnon broached 100 casks of wine for celebration. We were leaving for Troy on the morning's tide. Inside our tent, Achilles fell into exhausted sleep, his head in my lap. I stroked his forehead, watching the trembles of his dreaming face. In the corner lay his bloodied groom's tunic. Looking at it, at him, my chest felt hot and tight. It was the first death he had ever witnessed. I eased his head off my lap and stood. Outside, men sang and shouted, drunk and getting drunker. On the beach, the pyre burned high, fed by the breeze. I strode past campfires, past lurching soldiers. I knew where I was going. There were guards outside his tent, but they were slumping, half asleep. "Who are you?" one asked, starting up. I stepped past him and threw open the tent's door. Odysseus turned. He had been standing at a small table, his finger to a map. There was a half-finished dinner plate beside it. "Welcome, Patroclus. Oh, it's all right, I know him," he added to the guard, stuttering apologies behind me. He waited until the man was gone. "I thought you might come." I made a noise of contempt. "You would say that, whatever you thought." He half-smiled. "Sit, if you like. I'm just finishing my dinner." "You let them murder her." I spat the words at him. He drew a chair to the table. "And what makes you think I could have stopped them?" "You would have, if it had been your daughter." I felt like my eyes were throwing off sparks. I wanted him burnt. "I don't have a daughter." He tore a piece of bread, sopped it into gravy, ate. "Your wife, then. What if it had been your wife?" He looked up at me. "What do you wish me to say? That I would not have done it?" "Yes." "I would not have. But perhaps that is why Agamemnon is king of Mycenae, and I rule only Ithaca." Too easily his answers came to him. His patience enraged me. "Her death is on your head." A wry twist of his mouth. "You give me too much credit. I am a counselor only, Patroclus, not a general." "You lied to us." "About the wedding?" "Yes. It was the only way Clytemnestra would let the girl come. The mother, back in Argos." Questions rose in me, but I knew this trick of his. I would not let him divert me from my anger. My finger stabbed the air. "You dishonored him." Achilles had not thought of this yet. He was too grieved with the girl's death. But I had. They had tainted him with their deceit. Odysseus waved a hand. The men have already forgotten he was part of it. They forgot it when the girl's blood spilled. It is convenient for you to think so. He poured himself a cup of wine, drank. You are angry, and not without reason. But why come to me? I did not hold the knife, or the girl. There was blood, I snarled. All over him, his face, in his mouth. Do you know what it did to him? He grieves that he did not prevent it. Of course, I snapped. He could barely speak. Odysseus shrugged. He has a tender heart. An admirable quality, surely. If it helps his conscience, tell him I placed Diomedes where he was on purpose, so Achilles would see too late. I hated him so much I could not speak. He leaned forward in his chair. May I give you some advice? If you are truly his friend, you will help him leave this soft heart behind. He is going to Troy to kill men, not rescue them. His dark eyes held me like swift-running current. He is a weapon, a killer. Do not forget it. You can use a spear as a walking stick, but that will not change its nature. The words drove breath from me, left me stuttering. He is not, but he is. The best the gods have ever made, and it is time he knew it, and you did too. If you hear nothing else I say, hear that. I do not say it in malice. I was no match for him, and his words that lodged like quills, and would not be shaken loose. You are wrong, I said. He did not answer me, only watched me turn and flee from him in silence. Chapter 19. We left the next day, early, with the rest of the fleet. From the stern of our ship, Aulis's beach looked strangely bare. Only the gouges of the latrines and the ash-white ruins of the girl's pyre were left to mark our passage. I had woken him this morning with Odysseus's news that he could not have seen Diomedes in time. He heard me out dully, his eyes bruised despite how long he had slept. Then he said, "She is dead, all the same." Now he paced the deck behind me. I tried to point things out to him. The dolphins that ran beside us, the rain-swelled clouds on the horizon. But he was listless and only half listening. Later, I caught him standing alone, practicing drill steps and sword swings and frowning to himself. Each night, we put in at a different port. Our boats were not built for long journeys, for day after day of submersion. The only men we saw were our own Thians and Diomedes' Argives. The fleet split, so that each island would not be forced to give landfall to the entire army. I was sure it was no coincidence that the King of Argos was paired with us. Do they think we will run away? I did my best to ignore him, and he seemed content to leave us in peace. The islands looked all the same to me. High cliffs, bleached white, pebbled beaches that scratched the underside of our ships with their chalky fingernails. They were frequently scrubby, brush struggling up beside olives and cypresses. Achilles barely noticed any of it. He bent over his armor, polishing it till it shone bright as flame. On the seventh day, we came to Lemnos, just across from the Hellespont's narrow mouth. It was lower than most of our islands, full of swamps and stagnant ponds choking with water lilies. We found a pool some distance from the camp and sat by it. Bugs shivered on its surface, and bulbous eyes peered from amidst the weeds. We were only 2 days from Troy. "What was it like when you killed that boy?" I looked up. His face was in shadow, the hair falling around his eyes. "Like?" I asked. He nodded, staring at the water as if to read its depths. "What did it look like?" "It's hard to describe." He had taken me by surprise. I closed my eyes to conjure it. The blood came quickly, I remember that, and I couldn't believe how much there was. His head was split, and his brain showed a little. I fought down the nausea that gripped me, even now. I remember the sound his head made against the rock. Did he twitch? Like animals do. I did not stay long enough to watch. He was silent a moment. My father told me once to think of them like animals, the men I kill. I opened my mouth to speak, then closed it again. He did not look up from his vigil over the water's surface. "I do not think I can do it," he said, simply, as was his way. Odysseus's words pressed in on me, weighed down my tongue. Good, I wanted to say, but what did I know? I did not have to win my immortality with war. I held my peace. "I cannot stop seeing it," he said softly. Her death. I could not either. The gaudy spray of blood, the shock and pain in her eyes. "It will not always be like that," I heard myself say. "She was a girl and innocent. These will be men that you fight, warriors who will kill you if you do not strike first." He turned to look at me, his gaze intent. "But you will not fight, even if they strike at you. You hate it. If it had been any other man, the words would have been an insult." "Because I don't have the skill," I said. "I don't think that is the only reason," he said. His eyes were green and brown as forest, and even in the dim light I could see the gold. "Perhaps not," I said at last. "But you will forgive me." I reached for his hand and took it. "I have no need to forgive you. You cannot offend me." They were rash words, but I said them with all the conviction of my heart. He looked down a moment at where our hands sat joined. Then his hand ripped itself from mine and blurred past me so swiftly I could not follow it. He stood, something limp and long as a piece of wet rope dangling from his fingers. My eyes stared at it, uncomprehending.
"Hudros," Achilles said.
"Water snake." It was dun grey, and its flat head hung brokenly to the side. Its body still trembled a little, dying. Weakness sluiced through me. Chiron had made us memorize their homes and colors. Brown-gray by water, quick to anger, deadly bite. "I did not even see it," I managed. He threw the thing aside to lie blunt-nosed and brown among the weeds. He had broken its neck.
"You did not have to," he said. "I saw it."
He was easier after that, no longer pacing the deck and staring. But I knew that Iphigenia still weighed on him, on both of us. He took to carrying one of his spears with him always. He would toss it into the air and catch it over and over again. Slowly, the fleet straggled back together. Some had gone the long way round, south by the island of Lesbos. Others, taking the most direct route, already waited near Sigeum, northwest of Troy. Still others had come as we did, along the Thracian coast. United again, we massed by Tenedos, the island just off of Troy's wide beach. Shouting from ship to ship, we passed word of Agamemnon's plan. The kings would take the front line, their men fanned out behind them. Maneuvering into place was chaos. There were three collisions, and everyone chipped oars on someone else's hull. At last we were set, with Diomedes on our left and Meriones on our right. The drums began to beat, and the line of ships thrust forward, stroke by stroke. Agamemnon had given the order to go slowly, to hold the line and keep pace as one, but our kings were green still at following another man's orders, and each wanted the honor of being first to Troy. Sweat streamed from the faces of the rowers as their leaders lashed them on. We stood at the prow, with Phoenix and Automedon, watching the shore draw closer. Idly, Achilles tossed and caught his spear. The oarsmen had begun to set their strokes by it, the steady, repetitive slap of wood against his palm. Closer, we started to see distinction on the shore, tall trees and mountains resolving out of the blurring green-brown land. We had edged ahead of Diomedes and were a whole ship length in front of Meriones.
"There are men on the beach," Achilles said. He squinted. "With weapons!"
Before I could respond, a horn blew from somewhere in the fleet, and others answered it. The alarm. On the wind came the faint echo of shouts. We had thought we would surprise the Trojans, but they knew we were coming. They were waiting for us. All along the line, rowers jammed their oars into the water to slow our approach. The men on the beach were undoubtedly soldiers, all dressed in the dark crimson of the House of Priam. A chariot flew along their ranks, churning up sand. The man in it wore a horsehair helmet, and even from a distance we could see the strong lines of his body. He was large, yes, but not as large as Ajax or Menelaus. His power came from his carriage, his perfectly squared shoulders, the straight line of his back arrowing up to heaven. This was no slouchy prince of wine halls and debauchery, as Easterners were said to be. This was a man who moved like the gods were watching. Every gesture he made was upright and correct. There was no one else it could be but Hector. He leapt from the chariot, shouting to his men. We saw spears hoisted and arrows knocked. We were still too far away for their bows, but the tide was dragging us in, despite our oars, and the anchors were not catching. Shouts came down the line in confusion. Agamemnon had no orders. Hold position. Do not make landfall.
We are almost in range of their arrows, Achilles commented.
He did not seem alarmed by it, though around us there was panic and the sound of feet pounding the deck. I stared at the shore coming closer. Hector was gone now, back up the beach to a different part of his army. But there was another man before us, a captain, in leather armor and a full helmet that covered all but his beard. He pulled back the string of his bow as the line of ships drew closer. It was not as big a weapon as Philoctetes, but it was not far off. He sighted along the shaft and prepared to kill his first Greek. He never had the chance. I did not see Achilles move, but I heard it. The whistle of air and his soft exhalation. The spear was out of his hand and flying across the water that separated our deck from the beach. It was a gesture only. No spearman could throw half so far as an arrow could fly. It would fall well short. It did not. Its black head pierced the bowman's chest, drove him backwards and over. His arrow twanged harmlessly into the air, shot wild from nerveless fingers. He fell to the sand and did not rise. From the ships beside us, those who had seen, there were shouts and triumphant horns. The news flared along the line of Greek ships in either direction. First blood was ours, spilt by the godlike prince of Thyre. Achilles' face was still, almost peaceful. He did not look like a man who had performed a miracle. On the shore, the Trojans shook their weapons and shouted strange, harsh words. There was a group of them, kneeling around the fallen man. Behind me, I heard Phoenix whisper something to Automedon, who ran off. A moment later, he reappeared with a handful of spears. Achilles took one without looking, hefted it, and threw. I watched him this time. The graceful curve of his arm, the lift of his chin. He did not pause as most men did to aim or sight. He knew where it would go. On the shore, another man fell. We were close now, and arrows began to fly on both sides. Many hit the water, others stuck in masts and hulls. A few men cried out along our line. A few men fell along theirs. Achilles calmly took a shield from Automedon.
"Stand behind me," he said.
I did. When an arrow came close, he brushed it aside with the shield. He took another spear. The soldiers grew wilder, their over-eager arrows and spears littered the water. Somewhere down the line, Protesilaus, prince of Phulace, leapt laughing from the bow of his ship and began to swim to shore. Perhaps he was drunk, perhaps his blood was fired with hopes of glory, perhaps he wished to outdo the prince of Thyre. A spinning spear from Hector himself hit him, and the surf around him flushed red. He was the first of the Greeks to die. Our men slid down ropes, lifted huge shields to cover themselves from arrows, and began to stream to shore. The Trojans were well marshaled, but the beach offered no natural defense and we outnumbered them. At a command from Hector, they seized their fallen comrades and relinquished the beach. Their point had been made. They would not be so easy to kill. Chapter 20. We gained the beach and pulled the first ships onto the sand. Scouts were sent ahead to watch for further Trojan ambush, and guards were posted. Hot though it was, no one took off his armor. Quickly, while ships still clogged the harbor behind us, lots were drawn for the placement of each kingdom's camp. The spot assigned to the Thians was at the farthest end of the beach, away from where the marketplace would be, away from Troy and all the other kings. I spared a quick glance at Odysseus. It was he who had chosen the lots. His face was mild and inscrutable as always.
"How do we know how far to go?"
Achilles asked. He was shading his eyes and looking north. The beach seemed to stretch on forever.
"When the sand ends," Odysseus said.
Achilles gestured our ships up the beach, and the Myrmidon captains began unsnarling themselves from the other fleet lines to follow. The sun beat down on us. It seemed brighter here, but perhaps that was only the whiteness of the sand. We walked until we came to a grassy rise springing from the beach. It was crescent-shaped, cradling our future camp at the side and back. At its top was a forest that spread east towards a glinting river. To the south, Troy was a smudge on the horizon. If the pick had been Odysseus's design, we owed him our thanks. It was the best of the camps by far, offering green and shade and quiet. We left the Myrmidons under Phoenix's direction and made our way back to the main camp. Every place we walked buzzed with the same activities, dragging ships onto the shore, setting tents, unloading supplies. There was a hectic energy to the men, a manic purpose. We were here, at last. Along the way, we passed the camp of Achilles' famous cousin, towering Ajax, king of the Isle of Salamis. We had seen him from afar at Aulis and heard the rumors. He cracked the deck of the ship when he walked. He had borne a bull a mile on his back. We found him lifting huge bags out of his ship's hold. His muscles looked large as boulders.
"Son of Telamon," Achilles said.
The huge man turned. Slowly, he registered the unmistakable boy before him. His eyes narrowed, and then stiff politeness took over.
"Pelides," he said thickly.
He put down his burden and offered a hand knobbed with calluses big as olives. I pitied Ajax a little. He would be Aristos Achaean if Achilles were not. Back in the main camp, we stood on the hill that marked the boundary between sand and grass and regarded the thing we had come for, Troy. It was separated from us by a flat expanse of grass and framed by two wide, lazy rivers. Even so far away, its stone walls caught the sharp sun and gleamed. We fancied we could see the metallic glint of the famous Scaean Gate, its brazen hinges said to be tall as a man. Later, I would see those walls up close, their sharp squared stones perfectly cut and fitted against each other, the work of the god Apollo, it was said. And I would wonder at them, at how, ever, the city could be taken, for they were too high for siege towers and too strong for catapults, and no sane person would ever try to climb their sheer, divinely smoothed face. When the sun hung low in the sky, Agamemnon called the first council meeting. A large tent had been set up and filled with a few rows of chairs in a ragged semicircle. At the front of the room sat Agamemnon and Menelaus, flanked by Odysseus and Diomedes. The kings came in and took their seats one by one. Trained from birth in hierarchy, the lesser kings took the lesser places, leaving the front rows for their more famous peers. Achilles, with no hesitation, took a seat in the first row and motioned me to sit beside him. I did so, waiting for someone to object, to ask for my removal. But then Ajax arrived with his bastard half-brother Teucer, and Idomeneus brought his squire and charioteer. Apparently, the best were allowed their indulgences. Unlike those meetings we had heard complaints of at Aulis, pompous, pointless, endless, this was all business. Latrines, food supplies, and strategy. The kings were divided between attack and diplomacy. Should we not perhaps try to be civilized first? Surprisingly, Menelaus was the loudest voice in favor of a parley.
"I will gladly go myself to treat with them," he said. "It is my office." "What have we come all this way for, if you intend to talk them into surrender?" Diomedes complained. "I could have stayed at home." "We are not savages," Menelaus said stubbornly. "Perhaps they will hear reason." "But likely not. Why waste the time?"
"Because, dear King of Argos, if war comes after some diplomacy or delay, we do not seem so much the villains." This was Odysseus. "Which means the cities of Anatolia will not feel so much duty to come to Troy's aid."
"You are for it, then, Ithaca?"
Agamemnon asked. Odysseus shrugged. "There are many ways to start a war. I always think raiding makes a good beginning. It accomplishes almost the same thing as diplomacy, but with greater profit."
"Yes, raiding," brayed Nestor. "We must have a show of strength before anything else."
Agamemnon rubbed his chin and swung his gaze over the room of kings.
"I think Nestor and Odysseus are correct. Raids first. Then perhaps we will send an embassy. We begin tomorrow."
He needed to give no further instructions. Raiding was typical siege warfare. You would not attack the city, but the lands that surrounded it, that supplied it with grain and meat. You would kill those who resisted, make serfs of those who did not. All their food went now to you, and you held their daughters and wives as hostages to their loyalty. Those who escaped would flee to the city for sanctuary. Quarters would quickly grow crowded and mutinous. Disease would arise. Eventually, the gates would have to open, out of desperation, if not honor. I hoped that Achilles might object, declare that there was no glory in killing farmers, but he only nodded, as if this were his 100th siege, as if he had done nothing but lead raids his whole life.
"One final thing. If there is an attack, I do not want chaos. We must have lines and companies."
Agamemnon shifted in his chair, seemed almost nervous. Well, he might be. Our kings were prickly, and this was the first distribution of honor, the place in the line. If there was a rebellion against his authority, now would be the time. The very thought of it seemed to anger him, and his voice grew rougher. This was a frequent fault of his. The more precarious his position, the more unlikable he became.
"Menelaus and I will take the center, of course."
There was a faint ripple of discontent at that, but Odysseus spoke over it. "Very wise, King of Mycenae. Messengers will be able to find you easily."
"Exactly so."
Agamemnon nodded briskly, as if that had indeed been the reason.
"To my brother's left will be the Prince of Fire, and to my right, Odysseus. The wings will be Diomedes and Ajax."
All of these were the most dangerous positions, the places where the enemy would seek to flank or punch through. They were therefore the most important to hold at all costs, and the most prestigious.
"The rest shall be determined by lot."
When the murmur died, Agamemnon stood.
"It is settled. We begin tomorrow. Raids at sunup."
The sun was just setting as we walked back up the beach to our camp. Achilles was well pleased. One of the greatest places of primacy was his, and without a fight. It was too soon for dinner, so we climbed the grassy hill that lay just beyond our camp, a thin thrust of land emerging from the woods. We stopped there a moment, surveying the new camp and the sea beyond. The dying light was in his hair, and his face was sweet with evening, A question had burned in me since the battle on the ships, but there had been no time before now to ask it. Did you think of them as animals, as your father said? He shook his head.
I did not think at all.
Over our heads the gulls screamed and wheeled. I tried to imagine him bloodied and murderous after his first raid tomorrow.
Are you frightened? I asked.
The first call of a nightingale in the trees at our backs.
No, he answered. This is what I was born for.
I woke next morning to the sound of Trojan waves against a Trojan shore. Achilles still drowsed beside me, so I left the tent to let him sleep. Outside, the sky was as cloudless as the day before, the sun bright and piercing, the sea throwing off great sheets of light. I sat and felt the drops of sweat prick and pool against my skin. In less than an hour, the raid would begin. I had fallen asleep thinking of it. I had woken with it. We had discussed already that I would not go. Most of the men would not. This was a king's raid, picked to grant first honors to the best warriors. It would be his first real kill. Yes, there had been the men on the shore the previous day, but that had been a distant thing, with no blood that we could see. They had fallen almost comically, from too far away to see their faces or pain. Achilles emerged from the tent, already dressed. He sat beside me and ate the breakfast that was waiting for him. We said little. There were no words to speak to him of how I felt. Our world was one of blood, and the honor it won. Only cowards did not fight. For a prince there was no choice. You warred and won, or warred and died. Even Chiron had sent him a spear. Phoenix was already up and marshalling the myrmidons who would accompany him down by the water's edge. It was their first fight, and they wanted their master's voice. Achilles stood, and I watched as he strode towards them, the way the bronze buckles on his tunic threw off fire flashes, the way his dark purple cape brightened his hair to sun's gold. He seemed so much the hero. I could barely remember that only the night before we had spit olive pits at each other across the plate of cheeses that Phoenix had left for us, that we had howled with delight when he had landed one, wet and with bits of fruit still hanging from it, in my ear. He held up his spear as he spoke and shook its grey tip, dark as stone or stormy water. I felt sorry for other kings who had to fight for their authority or wore it poorly, their gestures jagged and rough. With Achilles, it was graceful as a blessing, and the men lifted their faces to it as they would to a priest. After, he came to bid me farewell. He was life-size again, and held his spear loosely, almost lazily.
Will you help me put the rest of my armor on?
I nodded, and followed him into the cool of the tent, past the heavy cloth door that fell closed like a lamp blown out. I handed him bits of leather and metal as he gestured for them, coverings for his upper thighs, his arms, his belly. I watched him strap these things on one by one, saw the stiff leather dig into his soft flesh, skin that only last night I had traced with my finger. My hand twitched towards him, longing to pull open the tight buckles, to release him. But I did not. The men were waiting. I handed him the last piece, his helmet, bristling with horsehair, and watched as he fitted it over his ears, leaving only a thin strip of his face open. He leaned towards me, framed by bronze, smelling of sweat and leather and metal. I closed my eyes, felt his lips on mine, the only part of him still soft. Then he was gone. Without him, the tent seemed suddenly much smaller, close and smelling of the hides that hung on the walls. I lay on our bed and listened to his shouted orders, then the stamps and snorts of horses. Last of all, the creaking of his chariot wheels as they bore him off. At least I had no fears for his safety. As long as Hector lived, he could not die. I closed my eyes and slept. I woke to his nose on mine, pressing insistently against me as I struggled from the webbing of my dreams. He smelled sharp and strange, and for a moment I was almost revolted at this creature that clung to me and shoved its face against mine. But then he sat back on his heels and was Achilles again, his hair damp and darkened, as if all the morning sun had been poured out of it. It stuck to his face and ears, flattened and wet from the helmet. He was covered in blood, vivid splashes not yet dried to rust. My first thought was terror, that he was wounded, bleeding to death. "Where are you hurt?" I asked. My eyes raked him for the source of the blood. But the spatters seemed to come from nowhere. Slowly, my sleep-stupid brain understood. It was not his.
"They could not get close enough to touch me," he said.
There was a sort of wondering triumph in his voice.
"I did not know how easy it would be. Like nothing. You should have seen it. The men cheered me afterwards."
His words were almost dreamy.
"I cannot miss. I wish you had seen."
"How many?" I asked.
12.
12 men, with nothing at all to do with Paris or Helen or any of us. Farmers. There was a bitterness to my voice that seemed to bring him back to himself.
"They were armed," he said quickly. "I would not kill an unarmed man."
"How many will you kill tomorrow, do you think?" I asked. He heard the edge in my voice and looked away. The pain on his face struck me, and I was ashamed. Where was my promise that I would forgive him? I knew what his destiny was, and I had chosen to come to Troy anyway. It was too late for me to object, simply because my conscience had begun to chafe. "I'm sorry," I said. I asked him to tell me what it was like, all of it, as we had always spoken to each other. And he did. Everything. How his first spear had pierced the hollow of a man's cheek, carrying flesh with it as it came out the other side. How the second man had fallen, struck through the chest. How the spear had caught against his ribcage when Achilles tried to retrieve it. The village had smelled terrible when they left it, muddy and metallic, with the flies already landing. I listened to every word, imagining it was a story only, as if it were dark figures on an urn he spoke of instead of men. Agamemnon posted guards to watch Troy every hour of every day. We were all waiting for something, an attack, or an embassy, or a demonstration of power. But Troy kept her gates shut, and so the raids continued. I learned to sleep through the day so that I would not be tired when he returned. He always needed to talk then, to tell me down to the last detail about the faces and the wounds and the movements of men. And I wanted to be able to listen, to digest the bloody images, to paint them flat and unremarkable onto the vase of posterity, to release him from it and make him Achilles again. Chapter 21. With the raids came the distribution. This was a custom of ours, the awarding of prizes, the claiming of war spoils. Each man was allowed to keep what he personally won. Armor that he stripped from a dead soldier, a jewel he tore from the widow's neck. But the rest, ewers and rugs and vases, were carried to the dais and piled high for distribution. It was not so much about the worth of any object as about honor. The portion you were given was equal to your standing in the army. First allotment went usually to the army's best soldier, but Agamemnon named himself first and Achilles second. I was surprised that Achilles only shrugged.
"Everyone knows I'm better. This only makes Agamemnon look greedy."
He was right, of course, and it made it all the sweeter when the men cheered for us, tottering beneath our pile of treasure, and not for Agamemnon. Only his own Mycenaeans applauded him. After Achilles came Ajax, then Diomedes, and Menelaus, and then Odysseus, and on and away until Cebrianus was left with only wooden helmets and chipped goblets. Sometimes, though, if a man had done particularly well that day, the general might award him something particularly fine, before even the first man's turn. Thus, even Cabrianus was not without hope. In the third week, a girl stood on the dais amidst the swords and woven rugs in gold. She was beautiful, her skin a deep brown, her hair black and gleaming. High on her cheekbone was a spreading bruise where a knuckle had connected. In the twilight, her eyes seemed bruised as well, shadowed as if with Egyptian coal. Her dress was torn at the shoulder and stained with blood. Her hands were bound. The men gathered eagerly. They knew what her presence meant. Agamemnon was giving us permission for camp followers, for spear wives and bed slaves. Until now, the women had simply been forced in the fields and left. In your own tent was a much more convenient arrangement. Agamemnon mounted the dais, and I saw his eyes slide over the girl, a slight smile on his lips. He was known, all the house of Atreus was, for his appetites. I do not know what came over me then, but I seized Achilles' arm and spoke into his ear. Take her. He turned to me, his eyes wide with surprise. Take her as your prize, before Agamemnon does. Please. He hesitated, but only a second.
Men of Greece.
He stepped forward, still in the day's armor, still smeared with blood.
Great king of Mycenae.
Agamemnon turned to face him, frowning.
Pelides?
I would have this girl as my war prize.
At the back of the dais, Odysseus raised an eyebrow. The men around us murmured. His request was unusual, but not unreasonable. In any other army, first choice would have been his anyway. Irritation flashed in Agamemnon's eyes. I saw the thoughts turn across his face. He did not like Achilles, yet it was not worth it here already to be churlish. She was beautiful, but there would be other girls.
I grant your wish, Prince of Thyre. She is yours.
The crowd shouted its approval. They liked their commanders generous, their heroes bold and lusty. Her eyes had followed the exchange with bright intelligence. When she understood that she was to come with us, I saw her swallow, her gaze darting over Achilles.
I will leave my men here for the rest of my belongings. The girl will come with me now.
Appreciative laughter and whistles from the men. The girl trembled all over, very slightly, like a rabbit checked by a hawk overhead.
Come,
Achilles commanded. We turned to go. Head down, she followed. Back in our camp, Achilles drew his knife, and her head jerked a little with fear. He was still bloody from the day's battle. It had been her village he had plundered. Let me, I said. He handed me the knife and backed away, almost embarrassed. I am going to free you, I said. Up close, I saw how dark her eyes were, brown as richest earth, and large in her almond-shaped face. Her gaze flickered from the blade to me. I thought of frightened dogs I had seen, backed small and sharp into corners. No, no, I said quickly. We will not hurt you. I am going to free you. She looked at us in horror. The gods knew what she thought I was saying. She was an Anatolian farm girl, with no reason to have ever heard Greek before. I stepped forward to put a hand on her arm to reassure. She flinched as if expecting a blow. I saw the fear in her eyes, of rape and worse. I could not bear it. There was only one thing I could think of. I turned to Achilles and seized the front of his tunic. I kissed him. When I let go again, she was staring at us, staring and staring. I gestured to her bonds and back to the knife. All right? She hesitated a moment, then slowly offered her hands. Achilles left to speak to Phoenix about procuring another tent. I took her to the grass-sided hill and had her sit while I made a compress for her bruised face. Gingerly, eyes downcast, she took it. I pointed to her leg. It was torn open, a long cut along her shin. May I see? I asked, gesturing. She made no response, but reluctantly let me take her leg, dress the wound, and tie it closed with bandages. She followed every movement of my hands and never met my gaze. After, I took her to her new pitched tent. She seemed startled by it, almost afraid to enter. I threw open the flap and gestured. Food, blankets, a ewer of water, and some clean cast-off clothes. Hesitating, she stepped inside, and I left her there, eyes wide, staring at it all. The next day, Achilles went raiding again. I trailed around the camp, collecting driftwood, cooling my feet in the surf. All the time I was aware of the new tent in the camp's corner. We had seen nothing of her yet. The flap was shut tight as Troy. A dozen times I almost went to call through the fabric. At last, at midday, I saw her in the doorway. She was watching me, half hidden behind the folds. When she saw that I had noticed her, she turned quickly and went to leave. "Wait," I said. She froze. The tunic she wore, one of mine, hung past her knees and made her look very young. How old was she? I did not even know. I walked up to her. "Hello." She stared at me with those wide eyes. Her hair had been drawn back, revealing the delicate bones of her cheeks. She was very pretty. "Did you sleep well?" I do not know why I kept talking to her. I thought it might comfort her. I had once heard Chiron say that you talk to babies to soothe them. "Patroclus," I said, pointing at myself. Her eyes flickered to me, then away. "Patroclus," I repeated slowly. She did not answer, did not move. Her fingers clutched the cloth of the tent flap. I felt ashamed then. I was frightening her. "I will leave you," I said. I inclined my head and made to go. She spoke something, so low I could not hear it. I stopped. "What?" "Briseis," she repeated. She was pointing to herself. "Briseis?" I said. She nodded shyly. That was the beginning. It turned out that she did know a little Greek, a few words that her father had picked up and taught her when he heard the army was coming. Mercy was one. Yes, and please, and what do you want? A father, teaching his daughter how to be a slave. During the days, the camp was nearly empty but for us. We would sit on the beach and halt through sentences with each other. I grew to understand her expressions first, the thoughtful quiet of her eyes, the flickering smiles she would hide behind her hand. We could not talk of much in those early days, but I did not mind. There was a peace in sitting beside her, the waves rolling companionably over our feet. Almost, it reminded me of my mother, but Briseis's eyes were bright with observation, as hers had never been. Sometimes in the afternoons we would walk together around the camp, pointing to each thing she did not know the name of yet. Words piled on each other so quickly that soon we needed elaborate pantomimes. Cook dinner, have a bad dream. Even when my sketches were clumsy, Briseis understood, and translated it into a series of gestures so precise that I could smell the meat cooking. I laughed often at her ingenuity, and she would grant me her secret smile. The raiding continued. Every day Agamemnon would climb the dais amidst the day's plunder and say,
"No news."
No news meant no soldiers, no signals, no sounds from the city. It sat stubbornly on the horizon and made us wait. The men consoled themselves in other ways. After Briseis, there was a girl or two on the dais nearly every day. They were all farm girls, with calloused hands and burnt noses, used to hard work in the sun. Agamemnon took his share, and the other kings as well. You saw them everywhere now, weaving between tents, slopping buckets of water onto their long, wrinkled dresses, what they had happened to be wearing the day they were taken. They served fruit and cheese and olives, carved meat and filled wine cups. They polished armor, wedging the carapaces between their legs as they sat on the sand. Some of them even wove, spinning threads from tangled clots of sheep's wool, animals we had stolen in our raids.